Let's start with a serenity prayer with your permission.
God,
grant me the serenity prayer to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I'm Tom Flynn. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Harbor City Speakers Group in Baltimore. And I've been with you guys since August 14, 1980. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor a few guys. I've experienced the steps in my life, and I'm such a slow learner. I had to experience them numerous times, and I'm not finished yet. I'm still continuing on this experience, and I like the experience. It's sort of joyful. It's more than just a trip for me in the recovery. It has been an adventure. That's what it has been for me. That's the reason I do it. It feels good. I like it. I'm an excessive person. I know you're not, but I'm an excessive person. In a general way, what we're going to do, Dave and I are going to talk with you about our experience, about the steps. Hopefully, we're not going to do any theory. You know, we're both a bit beyond that. And I'll let Dave tell you how far a bit beyond that he is. Hello. The 12 steps, and what are the purpose? Well, our literature tells us the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a series of principles spiritual in nature, which, if practiced as a way of living, can expel the compulsion to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. 1935, AA is talking about holistic healing, happily and usefully whole. It don't say a damn thing about hanging in there. That's the direction and the purpose. Not my understanding, but AA's. When do we put the steps in our lives? When is the best time? With a new person. Well, I think it's like my sponsor told me. When you work with a new man, think of it as working with concrete. See? That's the best way to look at it. I said, what do you mean? My sponsor is sort of funny. And he says, when concrete is wet, it's easy to work. When it dries out a little bit and starts to harden, if you got to change it, you need a jackhammer. So he suggested that we work with the newcomer right away while the concrete is still wet. Say, take the wet test. And that's what I did. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it is my opinion that I was told to do the step right away. I didn't want to. I was just like you. I wanted to study this thing, and I thought if I just got sober and the rest of the literature I could read by myself, thank you very much. I was a very intelligent fellow, you know. I was so intelligent, I was consulting a retired truck driver on how to live. Big Hopkins man, you know. Right. So I said, well, I just don't want to do the steps yet. They told me I should wait for the fog to lift. He says, you got to do the steps just to lift the fog. And I said the most spiritual words I've ever said in my life. Okay, Wally. And I did the step. Did the first step. Of and by myself, when it comes to alcoholism, there's not a doggone single thing I could do about it. Nothing. How do you know? Well, I tried willpower, wife power, social power, church power, law power, all other kinds of power, and failed. You could say that Tom had power failure. That's the reason I got here in the dark. The power is off. Tom had power failure. That is the whole description of Tom's illness, lack of power. It has more to do with not drinking. It has all to do with I don't know how to live successfully. The whole doggone diagnosis of poor living is set forth in the first step. If you're desperate. If you are not desperate, then you need some excuses to delay doing something, like let us study it. Oh yes, here I am with damaged material in my head, and I'm going to study it. Oh yeah, that's good. That's good. You can delay doing anything. You can delay it. You might delay the joy of living. Why would you want to do that, Tom? And I couldn't think of a lie fast enough. I lie, you know. And he had me. So we had to do the step. I am powerless. Now, we're not going to talk a whole lot about unmanageability. When I got to you guys, I was divorced from a marriage of 25 years. I come from an Irish Catholic background, and that doesn't sit lightly on the conscience. I was fired from a career job of 29 years. I had made a ton of money. When I was 8 years old, I had holes in the soles of my shoes, and I had a considerable amount of money, seven digits anyway, and I wasn't 35 yet. And when I was 48, I was sleeping under the railroad bridge. So I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt, and see, I'm in a powerless condition, so I'm not going to talk about it. Although I met some fellows who came in and they were so arrogant, they were like me, they refused to admit that they were powerless, that their life was a little bit unmanageable. I seen them come to AA, and I see them go. Most of them go. What happens when they go? Well, they're here, see?
Oh, yes, Tom. Yes. Oh, my life is unmanageable. Yeah.
They're around for a while, and after a while, they get a little job. No big job, like you used to have, because you can't get them bonded anymore. Right? Yeah. And then they get a little apartment. They can't get a mortgage anymore because they shot the hell out of their credit, you know. So that happens. And they get a little car, got to pay cash for it, but the title and the tags are all blown to the car. It's all one deal now. It's not scattered, you know. Some of you experienced that, and I did, so, you know. And they get a little girlfriend with teeth and all, you know. And he wakes up one Saturday morning. He says, oh, look, I like it. I don't have to go to work anymore on Saturdays and Sundays and bring work home. You know, this is a very plain little job I got. And my little car is all paid for. Well, no bank would touch it for a loan. What the hell? And I got a nice little apartment. Don't have to cut that grass, you know, 4 acres and ride mower. You know that, you know. And she's going to pick her up. We're going to go out, you know. And she says hello and goodbye at the right time. See, it's a pretty sharp girl. And all that stuff. And he says, my life is no longer unmanageable. Look how I am managing. And he's a goner. Wave bye-bye. He's gone. He's managing his own life. So I don't dwell too long on unmanageability. I dwell on powerlessness. And Dave is going to give you a real good reason why I dwell on powerlessness, because he knows me for a long time. And Dave has a forgiving heart because he still talks to me. So what I'm going to do is let Dave comment a bit, or ask Dave to comment a bit on powerlessness and move on to the second step for us.
Thanks, Tom. I'm Dave Dawes. I'm an alcoholic. Before we move on to two, Tom tried to, like, set the stage for why the steps are important and you know, sort of when we should go through them. And my experience, and those of you who heard me last night, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 19 years old the first time, and spent 3.5 years coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my experience is pretty simple, that if you ask what was different in the 3.5 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 12 and a half years of a sober life, the only thing that I can really identify that is definitely different is that I was willing to do all 12 steps. You know, in that 3.5 years, I couldn't seem to make it to 4. I could get to it, and then I would be hung up. And the reason that I believe that, for me, I would get hung up when I got to 4 is that I really wasn't convinced that I was powerless. And if you're really not convinced that you're powerless, you're not, at least I should speak for myself, and when I'm not convinced that I'm powerless, then I'm not willing to take actions that really, really are out of the ordinary, that really require effort and faith at a level that I've never had before. And when I looked at the 4 step, and I knew 5 followed, that's the only reason 4 was scary, I knew that it required me to disclose to someone else things about me which I had planned on keeping inside the rest of my life. And if you're not powerless, then you really don't need to go to those kind of lengths. You know, I mean, that's pretty extreme. I found out about powerlessness in June 23rd of 1990 when I laid in the hospital. That was my side of my head smashed in, paralyzed, with blood coming out of my ear. And the doctor was telling my family that if I didn't die, I would be a vegetable. You know, and I laid there knowing that that was after 3.5 years of my best efforts in Alcoholics Anonymous. My last year before that, 1989, when I went back and looked, I had not drank for over 330 days of the previous 365. That is better than 90%. You do 90% plus anywhere else on this earth, and they're going to say you're exceptional. You walk into a university, you do better than 90%, and you do it consistently, you'll graduate with honors. You know, you go to your job and you give them a high 90%, and you'll get raises and you'll get promoted. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you come and you don't drink for 90% of the time, and what you get is laying in a hospital bed with your head smashed and dying. and really for me, you know, I came in at 19, I wasn't even legal drinking age, and I was focused on unmanageability. I really was, because that's what gets our attention. You know, and for me, what got my attention was, you know, I had been an A student, and all of a sudden I was a C, rapidly drifting to a D and F student. You know, I was a pretty decent guy, and all of a sudden I'm you know, beating the hell out of my girlfriend, who I really do love and care about and don't want to do that to. I look in the mirror, and I don't recognize the person that's standing in front of me anymore. My friends are telling me there's something seriously wrong with me. Now, I stopped drinking, and I came to AA. And I probably made it that first time, I guess about 2 months, going to one meeting a week. And at 19, you know, I was already physically healthy when I came in. You know, alcohol hadn't even really affected me yet. So physically, of course, I'm, you know, I go back to the gym, I start working out, and, you know, it doesn't take very long to where I'm, you know, healthy as a horse and feeling good every day, sleeping, eating right, you know, working out a little bit. I feel great, you know, in a period of a month. You know, mentally, all of a sudden, when I stop drinking and staying up all night, when I show up at college and start, you know, doing homework and taking tests with the rest of the class, all of a sudden, you know, I hadn't done that much damage. I'm getting A's again. You know, and my girlfriend, you know, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm not hitting her, and I'm taking her out to dinner and treating her nice, and you know, she invites me back into the bed again. Great, you know. So no longer my life is unmanageable. It looks like everything's managing just fine. And I think, well, you know, I'm not even legal drinking age yet. You know? I've been a little premature with this alcoholism diagnosis. You know? And then I love the big book, because sometimes it gives us outs. And my out in the big book was somebody in a meeting. Thank God for that person. Read in the book that, you know, if you're not convinced you're an alcoholic, step up to the bar room. Try some controlled drinking. Try it more than once. It'll be worth it to get convinced. And I said, thank God. Like a gift from heaven. It was a spiritual experience. And so I stepped into the bar and I tried some controlled drinking, and it went really well the first night. And it went really well the second night. And then I don't know what happened on the third night, but I came to a day and a half later and figured the experiment didn't go so well. I better go back to AA. And what powerlessness, you know, has sort of been for me is it was, you know, the June 23rd, 1990 with my head smashed in and laying there in a bed was really just the, you know, sort of the conclusion of that 3 year being convinced of peace of my soul at a time. One of the things that really got my attention too with powerlessness was I drank twice on interviews in that 3.5 years, and I really that really got my attention because it wasn't one of these things. You know, I hear some people who drink, you know, after they come out of a treatment center, and they conveniently forget to take their interviews for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then they drink. You know, that's planned. Mine was I take the pill at 5 o'clock before I'm walking out the door, and I've taken the pill every day. And by 9 o'clock that night, a mental obsession settles in between my ears that I'm going to drink. And it doesn't matter that I've taken that pill that they say is going to make me feel like I want to die if I drink alcohol. And I drink. And I drink. And I was bone dry 5 months when I took that drink. And you know what the first reaction was? Whew, thank God. Thank God. I can remember walking into the bathroom of the bar. Oh, thank God. This feels so much better. And my body feels like I'm going to die, but on the inside, because I had just been white knuckling, God, hanging in there. It's miserable not drinking. And, you know, after 3.5 years of not doing the steps, and finally being convinced that I was powerless laying in that bed, knowing that, and it wasn't like when that happened, I knew I was going to get sober. What I knew was that I would drink again. What I knew was that somehow I had gone from not being that bad when I first came to you at 19 to being too bad for you. I would not get it. If I ever got out of this bed, I would drink again. I knew it. I knew it like I'm sitting here today. And just like I knew it then, I know today that of myself and by myself, I cannot keep from taking a drink. One more thing about the first step, and then we'll move on to two. You know, for a long time, I read the book. You know, and I read the book for those 3 years, and I'm not a dummy. I mean, you know, I think I'm a reasonably smart guy. I could read, and I did pretty well in school and was always a pretty good student. But somehow, I'd always get to chapter 5, and it'd say, being convinced we're at step 3, and I'd be like, what the hell happened to 1 and 2? Where are they? I'm chapter 5, and I've missed the first 2 steps somehow. And it took me a while of sort of careful reading and sobriety to find the first step, and the first step's found on page 30 in one sentence. It says we had to concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholics. And I like to use the example of the last presidential election when we talk about concessions. You know, for me, it was much like the presidential election. It, you know, when Al Gore conceded, when he conceded, it was over. There was no more debate about who should be president or who shouldn't be president. It was over. Period. And June 23rd of 1990, I conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. It didn't mean I believed I would get sober. I just knew that I was powerless over alcohol, and I knew it would only be a matter of time for it. And that was my concession. The second step, we talk about coming to believe in a power, capital P, greater than ourselves, could restore us to sanity. And, you know, and the first step, we talk about powerlessness, and then they do that capital P. They're sneaky. I noticed that capital P long before June 23rd in 1990, and I noticed the capital P in step 2 was followed by the capital G in the word God in step 3. They weren't misleading me about the direction that we were going. And I don't want to be misleading here today about the direction that this 12 steps are going. If I am powerless, as Tom said last night in his talk, the solution to powerlessness is to find power. And the book makes no bones about that. It really does. And I make no bones about it to guys I sponsor. I try to make no bones about the fact that this is really a spiritual illness and that only a spiritual solution is fixed. And that's the purpose of the 12 steps, the only purpose, is to produce a spiritual awakening. He tells us that in step 12. And when they talk about the insanity of alcoholism, you know, I had seen some psychiatrists and some psychologists a lot. I mean, long before I took a drink, you know, 4 and 5 years old. They're asking me what the ink blots look like. You know, they've got me banging nails and stumps. You know, they're buying me punching bags. And I've got the special folder at school. I mean, did you all ever have the folder? You know, when you go down, you're called down to the principal's office because you've done something that's terrible and horrible and tragic. And you've got little Johnny next to you who's a nice kid who you just, like, beat the crap out of for no apparent reason. And they pull out Johnny's little folder, and it's some little manila folder that has, like, one sheet of paper in it. And then they pull out the Dave Doss folder. And the Dave Doss folder is very thick. And it sits next to little Johnny's folder, and I know that I'm different. And I know that what's in that folder is all the things that are wrong with me, the things that make me different. Because when I grew up, it wasn't fashionable to be seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a counselor. And I can remember distinctively making excuses to my little friends about where I was going when I would go see these people on a weekly basis for years at a time. The insanity that they're talking about is not that. It's not being crazy. It's not mental issues. The insanity they're talking about, I believe, is not the insanity that seems to appear magically when I get to a certain point in my drinking. I am a Jekyll and Hyde drinker. You know, my reputation on the street was not that I was a badass, but that I was absolutely unpredictably crazy. And that has some real power, let me tell you. You know, you pull out a gun and just shoot it a couple of times, and it gets people's attention. You know? And you could be my best friend 1 minute, and I'd be beating you with a bottle the next. You know, and that was, and what they're talking about in the insanity is not the crazy things we do drinking. What they're talking about, and I'll describe to you one of the clearest examples of insanity. About May of 1990, I told you my sobriety date is June 23rd, 1990. About May of 1990, I had 3 months sobriety. I'd begun to work with Tom. I'd gotten to step 4. I'd had a vacation planned to go to California, Southern California, with a normal friend of mine. He was planning on going out there to live, and we were going out. I had a cousin out there, and we were going to go out and kind of scope out and try to hook him up with a place to live and you know, get a little vacation. And I had this plan for months. And so I said to Tom, you know, what do I do? Because I was worried about my sobriety. He said, well, you do what you do here. He said, you get out there, you call in a group, you get to some meetings, you pray, you take your big book, and you do what you do here, and you'll be fine. And I said, okay. And so I got out to California, and I you know, I had some jet lag. Now, I found out really you're supposed to have jet lag going the other way, but I felt tired. And my cousin, they had a big cookout. And so I did call in a group, and I did get a meeting the next day, but the next day we were going out on the boat, on my cousin's boat, and wound up at the beach, and we played some tennis, and really didn't make it to the meeting the next day. And the long and short of it is that after being out there for about a week, I found myself riding in a truck going to Tijuana, Mexico with you know, and I was physically sober as I am now. I was physically sober over 3 months. And as I'm riding to Tijuana, as we come into the town and we get out, and the thought came to me, spiritual experience, I'm not an alcoholic in Mexico. I don't know where these things come from. You know? And that, to me, is the insanity of alcoholism. Is that after a day, a week, or a month, we forget the horrible, terrible things, the prices that we've paid for our alcoholism, and we decide to drink again. You know, repeating that experiment over and over and over again. This time, it'll be different. I'm not an alcoholic in Mexico. I believed that, and I immediately followed it up with rationalization. It's all the people in Maryland that they're making me feel guilty about my drinking. I'm out here, you know, and there's nobody to make me feel guilty. It's really the guilt that makes my alcoholism so extreme, and you know, and now that I have all this self-knowledge about myself, and I just got straight A's, you know, going back to college, you know, I just found out that I had gotten straight A's that semester, and I was like, great, man. I was drunk within 5 minutes of having that thought. I was as physically sober as I am today, yet 5 minutes of drinking. That's the insanity of alcoholism as I see it. Before we go into three, you know, guys that I sponsor, I really don't spend a lot of time on one and two with them. I kind of, my feeling is either you're there or you're not. And where I start on that with one and two is I start them out of how it works on page 60. With the three pertinent ideas, and I ask them those three pertinent ideas. It says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and C, that God could and would if he were sought. And the next line says, being convinced we're at step three. So clearly to me, that's a very clear line to tell whether or not we're done with one and two. Are you convinced? Now, some of you probably have heard this story before, so forgive me, but, you know, I kind of like AA history. I've wound up becoming a little bit of an AA history buff, nowhere near the level that Tom is, but it kind of intrigued me. And somewhere along the way, I came across one of the original manuscripts of the big book. And after those three pertinent ideas, the original manuscript said, if you are not convinced, meaning of those three pertinent ideas, reread the book up to this point, and if you're still not convinced, throw the book away. And I believe what they were saying, or trying to convey in that sentence, is look, if you're not convinced, we can't help you. If you're not convinced that of yourself and by yourself, you cannot keep from taking a drink. If you're not convinced that you need some power to intercede in your life, then we just can't help you. And so that's really been my experience, is one and two were, you know, after having the side of my head smashed in, laying in a bed paralyzed, being prayed over by a priest, not knowing if I was going to live or die, I knew that I was paralyzed over alcohol, and I knew it would only be a matter of time before I would drink and I would die. I also knew that it would only be a matter of time before that the insanity that I had seen repeated over and over and over again in those 3.5 years in and out, of, you know, stepping up to the bar one more time and trying to control drinking. And after a while, you know, you just can't help but think. And even in my own insanity, I could even see just how crazy that was, how many times I repeated the same experiment and that the results were exactly the same, but yet I would still lie to myself one more time. And Tom said it many times, that I cannot drink on the truth. You know, if I really look at my life and I ask a sponsor or I ask the people who love me and who are around me the truth about myself, they will not tell me that it's okay for me to take a drink. There are guys that were, you know, every now and again I run into some, not even the old friends, but people that were around some of my old friends in different social events. And it's not unusual for one of them to bring up a story about me and say that, basically to the fact, man, we are so glad. And these aren't people that even knew me well. These are just people that are kind of on the periphery of seeing me. And I said, man, we are so glad you're not drinking anymore. And you were. I was at my high school reunion 15 years back in, was it June of this past year? I ran into a girl there that I hadn't seen in probably close to 15 years. And she was a couple years older than us, and she happened to have married one of the guys that was in my class. And I had been at her college graduation party. And she walked up to me and she said, yeah, I remember my college graduation party. She said, you were crazy. You know, and I said, I'm so sorry. I had no recollection of it. But these are, the point is that even 15 years of someone who I didn't even know that well, the first sentence out of their mouth is talking about the insanity of watching me drink. You know, and she had seen me struggle on and out. She was a good friend of a girl that I dated, sister, and they knew the whole story, you know. So we make impressions out there, you know, and powerlessness and unmanageability and the insanity of my alcoholism is the foundation for which I need the remainder of the rest of the 10 steps to follow. I mean, they clearly define the problem, and in step three, as Tom's going to take over now, is that we begin, I believe, to get to the solution of what is and how do we find that power. So I'll turn it back over to Tom.
Thank you, Steve. What we're going to do, I'm going to add a little bit more about two so that this thing just slides right into it, because that's how the steps really work in our lives. They don't work in a chopped up fashion. You know, one just moves on to the next if you're making progress. Very simple. One of the main things in recovery for me is to be totally convinced of what does not work. Our literature calls it letting go of old ideas. Oh, they're so gentle with it. I should be so gentle. You know, as soon as I get a little closer to halo polish, I will be. But for now, one of the things is, well, she's having denial. Oh, yes, that's terrible. Bull. In order to have denial, you must know the truth and say it ain't so. An alcoholic of my type does not know the truth. So I can't deny something I don't know. It's extremely simple. I am in delusion. And that's the word the book uses, doesn't it? Delusion. That's a difference. Oh, what's the difference? Delusion is to believe in a lie. The delusion is, next time it will be different. Well, how many times have you said that, Tom? 1638? And you think 1639 is going to be different? That's a delusion. Get it? We're not in denial. We're in delusion. We believe a lie to be the truth. That's the difference. Denial is to know the truth and say it ain't so. Delusion is to be ignorant of the truth and believe in a lie. It's not the same. It's a different form of insanity. Denial may be a moral flaw. Delusion is more of a mental flaw. A little bit different. It'll be different. No, it won't. No, it won't. I have the compulsion to drink. No, you don't. You don't tell me what I have. Well, I want to. I'm an alcoholic. I don't have a compulsion to drink until I pick up the first drink. And that sets up the physical craving, which is the compulsion. Now, if I don't drink, I don't set up a compulsion. It's like a little kid playing with matches. You know, if you take the matches away, he's not going to set mommy's kitchen on fire. It's very, very simple. Don't take away the matches. Take away the booze. He won't drink. Won't set up no compulsion. That's what a compulsion is. That is not the problem of the alcoholic. The problem of the alcoholic is the mental obsession. You know, a lot of alcoholics, when you decide to drink after you've been sober, the decision to drink is based on a sober mind. Before you picked up the drink, you were sober. And a sober mind has decided to pick up a drink. Woo. So you can't blame it on the booze. You ain't had none yet. Let's don't cop out on nothing. Mental obsession. Tom, in street language, what is a mental obsession? Mental obsession is an idea that overrides all other ideas to the contrary. All, even our own recent experiences. It's like a circuit breaker. It kicks in and kicks out the truth. Okay. What do you mean? Well, I remember going to watch my life. You want to see an example in me of the mental obsession? I'm going to watch Monday Night Football in a bar with a bunch of guys, right? Okay. I'll just drink a few. It's a sporting event. And oh, there's some real ugly woman in there playing the jukebox, right? And she's got to turn the doggone thing on real loud while the football game's going on. And she had very, very poor taste. She played hillbilly songs, you know. Or, poor taste in music and a very ugly woman. and we're watching the football, and I get drunk, and I don't know what the final score is, right? And there's an attractive woman down the end of the bar with an incredible taste in music. Now, somehow or another, we formed a mutual admiration society, she and I. And what followed, of course, well, this is AA. I wound up in lipstick in bad places, and I was still married at the time, and I didn't get home till about 4:30 in the morning. Now, to drive that home, I had remorse, embarrassment, guilt, all that crap. It's just Tuesday morning. I go to work late. Felt terrible. Couldn't eat. Nothing. Felt terrible. Wednesday, I had some soup, and, you know. Thursday wasn't too bad. I had a sandwich. And Friday, I was thinking about social drinking. Friday, like 4 days later, my recent experience of shame, guilt, delusion was of no value. That's a mental obsession. Very subtle. Very, very. It overrides the truth. It overrides our own recent experiences. I'm not proud of that episode. But if it has value for another person, then it wasn't wasted. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. We come to believe that in God's economy, absolutely nothing is wasted if we share it. My sponsor, the truck driver, I call him the Zen truck driver now, not to his face, but anyway. He tells me that when you have those experiences, and we'll come to those in 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, when you have those experiences and you keep them a secret, they will be a millstone, they'll drown your ass. Or if you share them, they will become a milestone by which you can measure how far you have come. Your choice is millstone or milestone. You still have a choice. That's the reason I call him the Zen truck driver. He just lays it out there, like I say. And now, we're going to move to 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him. Understood Him. Told my sponsor, can't do the third step, Wally. Why's that, Tom? Well, I don't believe in God. He said, say the damn prayer anywhere. God don't care what you believe. Only you care what you believe. And what you believe has got you here kneeling on the kitchen floor with an unemployed truck driver. And there I was, dealing on the kitchen floor. I mean, there I am. See? He says the prayer with me. Holding hands. Imagine that. Holding hands with a grown man, kneeling on his kitchen floor. Praise your God, I don't believe. Whew. That's desperation, ain't it? You're desperate, like Dave said. If you've conceded to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, you'll do it. If you got reservations and you got some old ideas you ain't let go of, you may not do that. And then how about the ego kicks in? You're still dealing down. Like me. Well, Wally, you told me I had to get honest. That's right, I told you that. I mean, I feel dishonest praying to a God I really don't believe in. Oh, he says, isn't that a shame? I says, you know, don't seem right, Wally. He said, how long did you drink, Tom?
27 years, Wally.
He says, it's a little late to worry about integrity, ain't it? Say the damn prayer. Say the damn prayer. That's all. Let's say it. So you say the damn prayer. Okay. That's it. Yeah. He says to me now, Tom, I know you have a few accomplishments in your life, but let me remind you of this.
A lot of men better than you and a lot of women better than you are prayed. And I'm thinking, that's true. That does cut through the crap pretty fast. A lot of men and women better than me pray. It's real simple. See, I ain't that special. I'm special, but not that special. See. And what was the main problem? What was the main problem? He says, we'll get to that later, but I'm going to give you a hint. One of the reasons you say you don't pray is you think that God's like you, and that's a major mistake. You people who don't do things you like, you don't like them. That's you, but that ain't God. God loves you. He doesn't approve of all the stuff you did, but he loves you. We'll get to that later. It's like a child. You may have a child that doesn't do the things that you like. Doesn't mean you dislike the child. It means you might dislike the actions of the child, but you still love the child. What do you think? You're a better parent than God? Stop upstaging God. Okay, Wally. That's spiritual words. Okay, Wally. What do you mean, turn your will and your life away? You hear people say, oh, turn it over. What a bunch of crap. Where did this crap come from? I used to do that. My sponsor said, that's crap. Everybody says it. Well, it's a lot of crap then. You know, what's the fellow today? I mean, he's a sponsor. It's a lot of crap. He says, you go out and make a decision, and you pray to God to help you do this stuff, like God's a high-priced bellhop. God ain't no bellhop. That's not what the third step's about. And then when it gets screwed up, you turn it over to God. I'll give it to God. Like he's some kind of a dumpster? God ain't no dumpster. You treat yourself like a dumpster, too, he says. You pile that garbage up and say, you were made for love, not for garbage. Them green things out of them parking lots, that's dumpsters. You ain't one of them. God sends love to you. You say, oh, send it, but I don't deserve it. I'm all filled up. You're filled up with garbage. Most spiritual, geographic lesson you could ever make is make a trip to the dumpster and get rid of it. Be empty to self and garbage. Make room for love. That's what the third step's about. Warning God. This is the third step. This is Tom. I know you know who I am, but sometimes I forget who I am. Let me know or tell me what you want me to do today. I would appreciate it if you would make it plain. Alcoholic, you know. P.S. Give me the gumption to get your will done. I am also wayward. That is my version of doing the third step. I seek direction from my higher power. That's what the third step's about. Give me direction, not give me help. If I ask for help, God's an assistant. Is that not true? If I ask for direction, God's the boss. Isn't that true? So you're either going to be the principal, one or the other. It can't be both. What hat do you want to put on this morning? So based on my track record, I say, God, give me the direction. Generally, his will is real simple. It's not complicated. It's never hard. His will for me every morning is, Tom, I want you to go to help my other kids. And I always cop a plea because I got some personal things I want to take care of. You know what I mean? I dabble a little bit in what I call the busies. The busies. Right.
I said, well, God, I'm not qualified to help your other kids. He says, Flynn, we've had this argument before, and I've always won. Do you have to do it again?
Yeah, just for old time's sake, God.
He says,
I'm not qualified, God.
He says, you never will be, but I am. Get your ass over there. Okay, God, don't get testy. I go, That's the whole deal. Does it work? Yes. Are you sure? Yes. What makes you sure? My experience. Have you put your money and your life where your mouth is? Yes. How? The company that fired me after I was there 29 years and they went through a couple vice presidents, all that crap, they hired me back and I stayed there for a while. And I decided in 1988 I was going to put these principles in all my affairs, or I was going to find some principles I could live by in all of my affairs. And I couldn't impose these principles on a business that I was not the owner of. I don't have a right to do that. So I quit this company who hired me back in my 38th year. I didn't retire, I quit. And I started a brand new company at age 57. That's right. Age 57. That company is now extremely successful. The guidelines for the founding of the company is the AA's 12 traditions. Believe it or not. It's very successful. Our total advertising budget in 14 years is still under $1. And the primary function is to carry this message. That's my primary function. I have three other associates in the same business with me. One will be celebrating his 20th anniversary this month, and he's in my home group. Another is about 11 years or 12 years, Joe, 11 years sober. And the other is 16 years sober, all recovered alcoholics. Right? What a pleasure this is to work in a business with men like this, men of principle. What a pleasure. Why am I telling you this? This has nothing to do with me. This has all to do with God. When we turn our will and our life over to the care of God, He will furnish you everything you need to get His job done. Would you hire a man to paint your porch and not give him the wherewithal to get it painted? What do you think, you're a better director than God? It's when the rubber hits the road. I've been there, and I got to report to you, this is what has happened to me. I just gave you a little up-to-date commercial version. Our business this year is 52% ahead of last year. Unheard of numbers. And you know what? It's not even my business. You know what it really is? I am the trustee for the operation of this business. That's what I am. I don't own it. I am the trustee. See? And the funds that I get from operating this business does not belong to me either. I'm the trustee for that. See that it's channeled to do his business. If you don't own it, it's easy to let go of it. Don't own it. I don't even own my next breath for my final solution to the pain of alcoholism with suicide. I am here on borrowed time. Doing your third step, I've realized the principal from whom I have borrowed the time. And if I am on his time, I best be about his business. It is not a complicated idea. This is my experience with the third step. Please read our literature if you're like me. I don't want to get close to God
that can't be no fun, right?
I used to think about God. I thought about the church people. That's a bad mistake. A lot of young men come to me and say they don't have problems with God. They have problems with a childlike version that they got in church, but they have outgrown that. See? But they haven't updated their version of God. That's what I find. Adult version of God. And Paul talks about it, putting aside the things of a child. You know, it's not new. Not a new idea at all. See? And it's fun. God does not make difficult terms for those who seek Him. As we drew nearer to Him, more was revealed to us. That don't sound like that's going to be hard, does it? It's like getting close to a girlfriend. God, dang, that's nice, ain't it? As you drew nearer, more is revealed. God's fun. God is fun. He loves you. For God's sake, join in the love affair with God. That's what it's about. Join in God's love affair. You know? Why do you hold yourself aloof from the greatest force, the greatest power, the greatest light, and the greatest love you will ever have? Why? Why? Just plunge yourself into God's arms and walk. And you'll find others with you there. And you talk about your love affair back and forth. And your heart will be light. And your eyes will light up. And people will come to seek what you're doing because you will become a power of attraction. And it's not even your own power because, Christ, you know you're powerless. Hey, Dave.
One of the things that I like about the third step is it's sort of very, very clearly bounded. I read the requirements to be convinced in the ABCs. And then we have the third step prayer. And I'd just like to read it. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. And for me, that first sentence means I can't run the show, God. You know, please help me. Show me what you want me to do. And Tom used the borrowed time analogy. And for me, when I came back after near-death experience, I really knew, you know, that according to all the medical professionals, my grandfather, I'll tell you this, and sort of sets the stage for my belief. My grandfather held my hand watching me die in that hospital that night. I told you that last night. My grandfather was a retired fireman and had been in the ambulance and been around people who looked like me an awful lot. He had seen people like me. He later told me that out of all the people that he'd seen who looked like me, he'd never saw one live. And so when I asked him, laying in that bed looking up at him, if I was going to die, based on his experience, he knew the answer. I knew that I was supposed to be dead, and I wasn't. And I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was the only shot that I had. I knew that my best efforts put me laying in that bed, more dead than alive. And it was very easy at that point to beg God to just let it be different. I'll do whatever it takes. And when Tom and a couple guys showed up at my house, couple weeks later, because I physically couldn't get out and go to a meeting, they brought a meeting to my home. I sat there at the table, and I didn't really become willing to do God's will as I see it today. What I became willing to do was what they were doing, you know, because I didn't have that bridge to God yet. And it wasn't that I didn't believe. I believed. But what I didn't believe until the fifth step was that God would help me. That's what I didn't believe. I thought I was too bad for God. I just thought I was too bad for God. And so, the 3.5 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I had said that third step prayer, and I had said it many, many, many times, I had expected God to send me a beacon, to send me a sign, to send me some kind of indication that I had turned my will and my life over to Him. And what I like so much about the third step in the big book is it starts off with that, you know, starts off with the requirements to go on with the third step. It gives us the prayer. You know, I offer my life to you.
It's yours.
Do with me what you want. God, just help me. Do whatever you want. Total surrender. Concession. Surrender. Very similar words. And then at the end of the third step, well, let me talk about what God's will is for me. And I had this image, I guess, coming in out of AA, and Tom talks a little bit about it, that somehow it would be hard. Somehow it wouldn't be much fun. It would require a lot of prayer on some very hard wooden benches. You know, I wouldn't laugh and joke and cut up anymore. It would be very difficult, whatever it was. All the things that I'd like to do, I wouldn't be able to do anymore. And he directed me to the big book on page 133. And on 133, there's one sentence, and it says, "We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free." We are sure. That's what he wants for us. Pretty good terms for the surrender. You mean, I'll surrender my will and my life to you. And out of this deal, I get happy, joyous, and free? Did I miss something somewhere? I thought this was supposed to be hard. I could be happy, joyous, and that's exactly what it's been. Who shit? I swear! You know, that's exactly what it has been. Happy, joyous, and free. The capital of G doesn't scare me anymore. And I like that they put it in past tense, as we understood him. And what that implies is that my understanding of God will change. We'll talk about that in the 11th step. That must change. My understanding of God does not remain stagnant. It does not remain in one position. If it does, I'm already going backwards. And any constant in the universe, in the physical world, has changed. One more thing about the third step that I really like is that it doesn't require a beacon or a sign from God in order to continue. If anything, it seems to me that what they tell me directly in the book, and this is where my sponsor and I had a little bit of a talk early on. I had heard some things about the fourth step, you know, and so I'm just going to set the stage for the fourth step, and then we'll take a break and come back to it. But, you know, one of the things that I had heard, and I don't know how many meetings, but it seemed like an awful lot. It seemed to be the philosophy at the time of a lot of people that I heard, and maybe still is today, largely, is that you don't want to rush into the fourth step. I mean, you know, God knows that, you know, I mean, I've been to a treatment center, and I swear to God, I was told the first three steps your first year. I really was told that. I mean, by probably well-intentioned people who just didn't know any better. But that's what I brought to you, was that knowledge. And so I'm sober all of, I don't know, maybe a month, and my sponsor's talking to me about this fourth step, and I said, well, shouldn't we, you know, slow down a little here? I mean, you know, I've really got 11 months left on the first three. And, you know, it's like Clint Eastwood with the big book. You know, he was so fast, I couldn't even see it come out, and it just came out to the right page, you know? And he's like, and he's like, all right, Mr. College Boy. He said, you said the prayer, and on page 63 at the bottom, it says, next, we launched, meaning after you've done the prayer, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step, which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Now, next, I had some wiggle room on next. I mean, it was very clear that was the next thing, but they didn't put any timing on it, right? So next could be tomorrow, it could be 11 months, right? I tried to wiggle out on next, but there was another sentence that follows this. Though our decision, and he reminded, the decision was the third step. Yeah, okay, we're clear on that. All right, I'm all right with that. Was a vital, life-giving, and crucial step, must be done. It could have little permanent effect, implying a timing, unless at once, oh shit. You know, now he's got me. And then he looked at me. He just sort of like now he's sitting there to go, what did that once mean to you? Followed by an effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Now we're on four at once. So I know that there are people who have different experiences with the steps. My experience has been directly out of that big book. when we got done with three, it was at once. You know, you weren't going to have a permanent effect. That had been my experience 3.5 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not get more than 5 months of sobriety because I never followed up with a constructive action in step four and get through step five to be unique, to not be different, and to not be placed in a position where God couldn't help me. And so I really believe that the third step, that I don't need a sign from God, that really the third step is simply a decision to continue on with the program of action, which is the fourth step. All right? Thanks.
We'll take a break.
Take a break.